because I am sort of an NPR junkie, I was listening to the radio show This American Life, and I heard a story just yesterday, actually, about a woman who died of cancer at a relatively young age, leaving her teenage daughter behind to make a way for herself in the world. More than anything, this dying woman wanted to be a part of her child's life and growth. So she spent the last month of her life writing birthday letters for her one and only daughter. They were letters that the girl, Rachel, would open one at a time each year for as long as they would last, with one extra for the day of her wedding, just for good measure. It all started out pretty great. Rachel opened the first letter on her 17th birthday, and there was her mom as if she had never gone, reminding her that she was not alone, reminding her that a mother's love never, ever died, and that everything she did was watched over with grace and devotion by the woman who would always care. It was inspirational and beautiful and hard. And as the years went by, Rachel sometimes wasn't sure if she wanted to open the letters from her mother or not. She wasn't sure if she wanted her mother's annual advice, admonishments to go to church, reminders that she was to strive and excel and seek greatness, and a recurring theme that made it clear she was never, ever to marry anyone but a Mormon man. By the time Rachel was 21, opening the letters actually became something of an ordeal. And on the day of her wedding, which was to a man quite outside of her mother's faith of choice, she was relieved when the FedEx envelope with Mom's letter in it magically got lost in the mail. Nothing could be clearer in all the world than that this woman loved her daughter. Nothing could be more true, even in the face of death, than the transcending love she held for that child that captured all of her will in her final days and found its way into expression in those many thousands of words of post-mortem advice and devotion. And yet every time Rachel read one of her mother's letters, letters positively steeped in love, she found herself simultaneously comforted and newly aggrieved. Even in the best times, when the letters were all about comfort, the daughter put down each new missive freshly pained at the absence of her mother, reminded all over again of the fact that she would not see her face, that the bond between parent and child was forever a distant or at least different one, just over the horizon, never quite visible again, and that most of her love would now find expression in a strange combination of frustration and longing. This story, for me, is an illustration of just how complicated love is. It is no simple thing to love another, especially one gone or distant or remote. It is no simple thing to love at all. There it is. All this grace, all this beauty, all this love there for the taking in this world. There it is. Days and moments just steeped in it, when nothing in the whole world is more true than the fact that love is real and beauty is astonishing and there are miracles all over the place. But just on the other side of grace lies yearning. Yearning for the moment now past, for the connection unattainable, for the beauty we might have known or come to know but cannot reach out and grasp, not yet or ever. Just on the other side of grace and abundance lies yearning. And in the poem we opened with this morning, Rumi reminds us that yearning is sometimes the closest thing we will ever have to communion with that which we love the most. Any of us who have lost a loved one know that on the other side of loss, yearning is sometimes the closest thing we have to communion with the ones who are no longer here. Likewise, Rumi's poem tells us, it is only when we yearn to see God's absent face that we come anywhere near to the great and glorious mystery that holds us and heals us even when we don't deserve her grace. In Love Dogs, the prayerful man cries out over and over again to Allah without hearing so much as a whisper in return. He is shouting into the dark. He is scratching out a love letter to one who will never, can never write a response. And when he sleeps, the guide of souls comes to him and says, "Why did you stop praising?" "Because I never heard anything back." This longing you express is the return message. The yearning itself is the closest thing to God. Rumi says there are love dogs who spend days and nights and lifetimes crying out for the absent master, and reminds us that we should give our lives to be one of them. "Offer your love," he says, "even and especially when there is no response but more yearning. Offer your love," he says, "even when the loving is blissfully unrequited and all you yearn for, including God, remains distant. Love anyway." The great German theologians of the 20th century had a word for this longing, this painful, sweet love that will not let us go. I'm going to mispronounce it, but work with me. It's Sehnsucht, and while it's not entirely translatable, it's something at the intersection of devotion and obsession. Unending and unrequited love that captures you and will not lessen its hold upon you no matter what. C.S. Lewis called it the inconsolable longing in the human heart for we know not what. And he said that there are some beautiful things in this world that create that kind of unrequited longing in him, calling the object of all of his longing that unnameable something, desire for which pierces like a rapier at the smell of a bonfire, the sound of wild ducks flying overhead, the opening lines of Kubla Khan, the morning cobwebs in late summer, or the noise of falling waves. It seems to me that C.S. Lewis yearned for someone or something to thank, that the love which would not let him go was the nagging and unreachable itch to praise the source of such wonder and beauty, and to truly bow before the painter who made the sunset and the musician who tuned the falling waves. His yearning was to finally place his gratitude somewhere, upon the shoulders of the source of wonder. And no doubt he died still yearning, in love with the keeper of the stars right up to the very end. Even Einstein was in love with the keeper of the stars. Even the greatest scientific mind of his age knew the timeless yearning that wouldn't let him go. "To know what the old one thinks," is how he put it. Other astronomers and physicists have paused in the midst of their calculations just long enough to sit with rapt wonder, so close to understanding the mystery, to admire the glory of it all. Even the rationalists yearn for an experience of truth and beauty so profound it leaves them speechless. And even the rationalists want to sing the praises of the mystery that holds together this truly elegant universe. We Unitarian Universalists have a proud tradition. We are the inheritors not just of the great rational tradition of Unitarianism, but also of Universalist theology. And the Universalists, some of you know, were the branch of the American Protestant tradition where folks didn't believe in hell, where people really believed that all were made to be saved. The universalists were the ones who truly believed that the very function of God was to love not just the chosen, but all of us, no matter what. That was and is a powerful statement about the God of our forebears. And I've preached before about what it might be like to assume, even for a little while, just assume that we are loved without measure by a God like that. Even if you don't believe it, what would it be like to live as if you are held in the arms of a source of all love, and that you matter so deeply that when you weep, God sheds tears too? What would it be like to live that way? As if you are loved. How would it transform your days? And what would it take to actually believe it? I've preached that before, and I'll preach again, about the love of that universalist God, and the great surmise we might choose to make to live as if we are held within her arms. Others have preached about that, always drawing us into the question of God's love and our relationship to it. But until now, I've never given much thought to what it's like not just to be loved by a God like that, but to love God right back. Not just to receive the blessings of the source of life, but to bless God in return. To be honest, it is a difficult romance between me and God. Beginning with the fact that in purely practical terms, I don't actually believe in Him. That is, I do not believe in a person or being who controls everything and bosses people around and has anything whatsoever to say about whether I eat meat on Friday or fail to come to church or say the occasional swear word, which I do. So loving someone that does not technically exist is, you know, something of a challenge. And yet I do love God. Like C.S. Lewis, I look upon the most breathtaking things, the people who fill my life, the perfect wonder of the human body, the tiny little hands of a tiny little person, and my whole being knows that I am in the presence of the holy, and all there is to do then is give in to the love I know I feel for the source of all that grace. I do love God, and that love, like most love, is a complex thing. I heard someone say once that good news doesn't mean good times, and loving God is not always a fun business. Back in my adolescence and young adulthood, I used to spend a lot of time hanging out with Catholic nuns. And the sisters I knew best always wore a wedding ring on the third finger of their left hands, always. The moment they took their final vows was the moment they considered themselves once and for all married to Jesus and through Jesus connected always to God. On a lot of levels, Jesus is a pretty terrible spouse. He never comes home for dinner. He's utterly non-communicative, and frankly, he hogs all of the attention even though he's never around. But these women, the best and the healthiest among them anyway, and they're not also healthy, but the best and healthiest of them knew what it was like to be Rumi's love dogs, calling out for the absent master, expressing their love, not because they had to, but because it was the only honest thing they could do. They were in love, like C.S. Lewis and Einstein, and they wore those rings as an outward symbol of their inner devotion, a devotion that they could not, would not ever choose to remove. At a minister's conference I just came back from, my friend Lynn Strauss preached a sermon in which she said, "The God I don't believe in made me for this." And I sat there listening to her preach and blubbering into my conference program, mopping up my tears with the agenda for my next meeting. The God I don't believe in made me for this. To stand here and tell you that I am in love with her, even if I shall never see her face, And even if she might not technically exist, and even if I shall moan my love song into the void forever, the God I don't believe in made me for this, and I am grateful. What did the God you don't believe in make you for? Or perhaps the God you believe in with all your heart? It is my experience that many people, including quite a few of us, spend an awful lot of time being angry at God, even when we don't believe in Him. But those of us who do consider ourselves wholeheartedly believers spend surprisingly little time being in love with her. Not afraid of God, not appeasing God or defending God, but loving God. And whether I intellectually believe in Him or not, that's the kind of relationship I want with the Almighty. It is a quintessentially universalist enterprise to be loved by God and to love God in return. Even and especially when God feels so very far away that love is mostly just yearning. And I return to that teenager, Rachel, opening one of her mother's letters every single year. Each year once again brought close to the one she loves, and each year made once again to face the pain and the yearning of her absence. Was it better for Rachel to have those letters, those glimpses at the absent beloved, or so much worse, because love is such a complicated thing? I'm not sure. Is it better for those dogs to moan endlessly for the master? Is it better to love the possibly non-existent and yet ever-present source of grace, or to let it go and not think on the place where all my gratitude should land? I'm not sure. But Rachel never could stop opening the letters. And I could not, even if I wanted to, stop singing the praises of the source of love itself. And conveniently, unlike Rachel's long-lost mother, the God I love doesn't care if I marry a Mormon or not. The God I love doesn't care if I eat fish on Friday. The God I love, and maybe do believe in, after all, is not even omnipotent or omnipresent. The God I love is not able to wave a magic wand and fix my problems. The God I love is the first one to weep when human beings perpetrate human evil upon one another, and the first one to cheer when I rise above my limitations and do something decent with my day. Universalist theologian Philip Yancey once said, "There is nothing we can do to make God love us more. There is nothing we can do to make God love us less." And being a good universalist, I believe him. But I wonder, held by a yearning that will not let me go, if there is something I can do to love God more, or at least to express my gratitude more, to stand more often before the keeper of the stars and cry wonder. Because even in the worst of times, even when she can't fix anything, the God I love has never wholly let me down. The God I love is the unlikely light that creeps up underneath the darkness. The glimmer that never fully dies, no matter how hard we try to stomp it out. No matter what heaps of shame and guilt and grief we pile on top of it, she is the light that does not cease to shine no matter what. And she is both far, far away and quite immediately present. And every time I glimpse a passing shadow of her face, which is all I will ever get, I yearn for a little more. Even though I'll spend my whole life yearning. Thank you.